Welcome to the Engle Podcast, where we explore the intersection of technology, creativity, and innovation in Africa. Today, we're very happy to welcome Mark Harris, the CEO of the Tsimogolong Digital Innovation Precinct in Johannesburg. Mark is at the forefront of fostering digital creativity and tech-driven change, guiding an incubator that's redefining how technology, creativity, and entrepreneurship intersects, not just here in Johannesburg, but with a continental scope. Tsimogolong has become a hub for ambitious young talent and visionary startups, offering everything from maker labs and animation studios, game development, in-tech training, and hands-on support for entrepreneurs. It's a catalyst for digital transformation, and not only as a creative outlet, but as a powerful economic driver, bringing new job opportunities and to a continent where youth unemployment is a pressing issue. In today's conversation, we'll hear Mark's insights on how technology can shape a brighter, more inclusive future. I'm your co-host, Scott Peter Smith, co-founder of The Engle, a platform dedicated to exploring African perspectives on digital culture, media, money, and governance. And to my right...
It's myself. I'm asked to introduce, I'm Stanley, the founder of The Engle. Easy, right?
Cool. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for coming through.
An important guest we have today, our boss.
Your boss, maybe. I don't know. we're still talking,
you
know.
Are you a tenant or are you not a tenant?
Not yet.
Mr. Harris.
Are you there, Stan?
How are you doing?
Right, and you?
Good, good. Do you mind just introducing yourself to our guest, who Mark Harris is?
Yeah, sure. So Mark Harris is originally from Johannesburg, did my schooling in KZN, went to Wits, and then as a youngster joined a company called IBM, and I stayed with IBM for 34 years.
34 years.
Yeah, of which I ran the Africa and Middle East region, as well as South Africa, for about 12 years. Then I needed to get back to South Africa, and which I did after that stint. So then I came back here and I joined Kagiso Media. So I headed a media group for about 5 years. Mm-hmm. And then since then, some other stints, one with running a company at Altron Nexus. And then Wits twisted my arm to come and help at the Tsimogolong Innovation Hub. I was on the board, so I think it was just almost a natural selection for them, for me to try and help them and having lots of fun. So that's who I am.
Am I a good tenant?
Yes, you're a brilliant tenant. I know Scott thinks differently, but the reality is...
And you're sitting right next to me.
I know, Stan, that's not good. So it's good to have you guys with us. I mean, you're very collaborative. I know that the ecosystem is working with you there, so please don't leave, Stan.
Well, you convinced me to stick around a little bit, so here I am.
I must be doing something right.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So I thought maybe if you could also just define the precinct a little bit for us. I've known a number of iterations through the years. I met the Prof. Dwalatsky. In fact, I pitched something to him. In fact, when I was at ENCA, this must have been maybe in 2015, 2016. It would have been 2016, I think, where we pitched in a series of things, which ultimately didn't happen. But nevertheless, it was a little bit different then. And I've seen it grow and change through the years. So maybe from your perspective, if you can just define it for us.
Sure. So, Prof. Barry Dwalatsky, who died last year, I was very close to. I mean, we spent an enormous amount of time every Tuesday and Thursday for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Just talking about, what we needed to do. So there were two entities. The one was a thing called the Joburg Center for Software Engineering, which was the forerunner to Tsimogolong. And for my sins, I think he had pulled me on, so I basically chaired that business from the beginning. If you understand Prof. the man, if you don't mind, I'm going to spend a few minutes.
Please do.
That's fine.
Please do.
So Prof. Dwalatsky was an activist from the ANC point of view, but a man whose heart was made of pure gold, right? I mean, his whole philosophy in life is how to help disenfranchised youth. So everything he did was linked to that, whether he was raising money, whether he was running programs, whether he was a lecturer. And that's how we focus the JCSE. Mm-hmm. Myself, coming from a more commercial background,
yeah,
I kept pushing in one direction and he would correct me and pull me in another direction again. It says, look, we can't leave people behind. So when you're talking about matriculants, and a lot of the programs he did was try to help matriculants, even though we were a center of WITS, and Tsim Lo Gong is 100% owned by WITS. He had this passion to help all youth.
Right.
So based off that, you know, as he was running the JCSE, in the rest of the world, you started to see the emergence of these innovation hubs. You saw these things, the very successful ones linked to universities. Mm-hmm. And he went on a couple of trips actually, just to have a look what was happening in London, what was happening in the US, and what was happening in Asia. And he then came back, and I mean, the forum that he had was the JCSE, and said he had negotiated these empty buildings in Braamfontein, it's close to the university, and he wanted to launch this thing. And we, at that stage, we had zero money, right? So there was a lot of discussion about the amount of money, because we had to renovate all the buildings.
Yeah.
But if you're no profit, doesn't give up. And so we just kept plugging away. It was an interesting thing, because one of the things that I knew that was that, you know, in Dubai they have a saying, let us build and they will come. And I think that was the first part of our strategy. Mm-hmm. So let's get the physical construction. But the reality, the funders don't want to fund infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to go out almost cap in hand. Fortunately, being linked to the university, we had some funders who were keen to help. And so we raised the funds. And then Tsim Lo Gong, and you know, the name comes from him. I always say it's a very difficult name to produce. You know, and it takes people a while actually to be able to say it properly. But he had this thing that it's got to be, he had chosen that name. And even the location of Tsim Lo Gong, he wanted it in Braamfontein. He didn't want it in the university.
Mm.
He wanted it on the outside, because he felt it's got to be accessible specifically to black youth who stay at all the student reses, who come from the bus terminus, they have to walk past from the stations. Because at some stage, you know, many of us felt, you know, that the advantage would be more into maybe a different area. But just who the man was like, this is where it's going to be. And we built from there. So remember, he was a professor from a software engineering and information systems point of view. He then, a lot of the thinking, so I mean, I saw the transition around the original programs was deep in software engineering and in embedded engineering. And then I think I was the catalyst that helped him to understand that this new digital world was upon us.
Mm-hmm.
I had my own learnings as to how I had to make people understand that there's two worlds actually. At that stage, it was an IT world and there was a digital world. And never the twain do meet. And that was mainly from the digital guys who thought the IT world was dinosaur and legacy. But Prof was brilliant, because he quickly realized the importance and what digital transformation was starting to occur in South Africa. But if you go back to whether it was JCSE or Tsim Lo Gong, we ran a lot of internships, a lot of learnerships. One thing that he picked up was that sometimes, especially when you're dealing, as an example, with matriculants, or even graduates for that matter, you had to do a lot of the softer skills.
Yeah.
Because the youth are different, you know what I mean? Historically, people would come out and you would be whipped into shape very quick by a corporate. But the youth know what they want, right?
Yeah.
And so, but he had to get some of the business training, some of the etiquette. So we ran these programs, many of them. We had great sponsors that aligned to us. So, and then part of that was, while I was at IBM, was starting to negotiate about getting the first proper research lab into Africa. So it didn't move as quick as it wanted to, so we started a smaller lab in Kenya, but the real first major lab in Africa with IBM, and IBM co-located. And this is a real deep research lab. Mm-hmm. It's not a lot of people will put some technology room and call it a lab. This is a proper lab where they've got the type of deep scientific and technological.
They have one of the most powerful computers on the continent, or they did at the time when they opened.
Yeah. So
is it still there?
Yeah, it's still there, but the technology in that thing has changed, right? Okay. So, the supercomputers or the deep computers. I mean, I brought a deep computing at some stage even to help government with the Center for High Performance Computing. That was the first one, actually, that came into Africa. I still have scars on my back of doing that. But it grew from it started growing. So a lot of if you understand software engineering and what he did at Simulacong, I think there were two transitions.
Right.
The one was from the traditional teaching people Java and teaching people C++, etc. It then went into more of the innovation plays around the digital side, and that changed the game. But then the third event happened, is that a lot of the things we do at the moment is with bilateral agencies, specifically from the European governments. So whether it's the French, the Germans, the Swiss, the Irish is the big partner of ours. And, there's this new belief, and the new belief that is that to help economies globally, you're not going to, no matter how much training you do, corporates are not going to be able to hire. The world is changing, whether we like it or not. Corporates are automating, they're starting to use AI.
Right.
So, before in South Africa, there were different phases. There was a phase at our transition stage about, as an example, not having enough black youth at universities. And whether people see it or not, I think government did a lot to get the universities first to change. But also you saw this transition of black youth wanting to get to university, despite some of them, the financial pressure. So there's wonderful stories about there. But then it became the next thing, that what did they study at university?
Right.
And unfortunately, the role models at that stage tended to be people initially were in the softer side, political science, theology, etc. So the youth get affected by who they see as the youth models. But then what I call the era of the emerging black capitalist games. And where were they all focused? In mining, right?
Yes, of course.
So then
that's where the money is.
Then you saw this flood of people wanting to get into mining. And it's hard. That engineering degrees in mining is hard, right?
Yeah.
We also had to fix up the STEM, the STEM subjects, because at one stage our youth didn't want to do it, but, things have changed totally now. So that was the next era. So we went through era with a lot of people trying to get engineering, because you had the Patrice Motsepe's and all these guys as their role models, Mzik Malo, those guys. And then what I think the best thing for the country was is that the digital age became apparent. And, when you think of Elon Musk, you think of the Mark Shuttleworths. And then we saw the youth starting to take interest in ICT and in technology. And I think that's the phase we're in at the moment. But I also think as an economy, we are at the point now where people weren't in university and the youth have gone to university. The youth are now in really important positions in the country, but we can't fix the unemployment because corporates are just happening. So this realization is a long story to get you to this point, is that you have to develop startups and SMMEs,
right?
Because they're the ones who are going to employ and create work opportunities for people into the future. And I think that's where we are. You've got someone here sitting who's a testament to that.
And I mean, that JSE program, that was great.
Yeah.
I picked up a few contracts from that program. There are a number of your graduates that created businesses from that project. And they came through and we helped them with a few designs. I myself picked up, I have your signature on one of my certificates, where I did user-centered design.
Yeah.
Right, through that very same project, because I saw the quality of the skill that came through that program. I myself subscribed to the program and just went through user-centered design.
Yeah.
So that was great. I'm wondering, is it something that we're going to see happen going forward, or has it stopped entirely?
No. It's so I'm busy with it at the moment. You know, the need for me to come and, I sort of have plans for the JCSE.
Okay.
But with the emergence of Tsimulo Gong, it has taken up quite a lot of my time.
Mm-hmm.
But next year, it's already started. We've got some really big programs that's going to reestablish the JCSE within the university and externally. So you'll probably see a different, and you know, with the emergence of the newer technologies, AI, etc., we've had to change the programs. So we think that the JCSE will get properly scale. It will properly scale next year in 2025.
The relationship of Tsimulo Gong and WITS, Tsimulo Gong is a WITS enterprise. Will we see a point where entrepreneurs at the precinct can leverage off of the research made at WITS to create solutions that speak to what WITS has researched and find to be real-world problems?
It's a very good question, and it's one of the things. So initially when I came in, which was in February this year,
yeah.
Remember, I probably am one of the people who understands Prof Barry's vision, right? And his vision was for Tsimulo Gong to be an enabling thing and using WITS to its fullest. And it wasn't there. So a large part of this year was reestablishing links with the university. The second part of that is that to tap into the resources, and by resources I include the deep skills, but also the research and the IP. So Dr. Adam Pantanovich are collaborating around making that available. So there's two parts to this industry that we play. The one is something called spin-outs.
Okay.
So spin-outs are professors, PhD students who sit inside the university. They do, so like, you know, Pico Power, or except for some of those successful spin-outs. So what you have, a professor or PhD students who come up with the research. Out of that, they get a great concept.
Yeah.
And then the university has got the spin-out processes in order for them to create new enterprises. I have to do the same thing, but not necessarily just out of the university. But more and more in our challenges, Stan, we're starting to see that where you make the research and the product available to startups, and I mean, and that's the aim of having this ecosystem, they can create successful businesses. So it's not like we're only doing spin-outs. It's about how do we make that. So I would say we're 50% of the way there, but we need to get that to 100% of having that alignment. And unfortunately, there's no central place. There's someone who reads research.
Yeah.
But every school, you will find there's research. But, you know, if you just think about some of the areas, so green tech, there's research right across the university around green tech.
Right.
Some of the research and the innovation is very, very strong. And yet you've got startups coming through. And if you, to your point, if you get that alignment and pairing up between the two, we get great companies will start to emerge, not just the spin-outs, but also the what I call the open ecosystem.
So just to follow up on that point, I mean, you know, coming from a media perspective, I'm always interested in the storytelling and in the public perception of what's going on, and also making the public a little more aware of what's going on with all these great initiatives. I mean, you take two obvious examples that fall under Tsimulo Gong that's been there for a little while, which would be the Fakugezi and the Civic Tech Forum. How do you feel those events that are somewhat a little more public-facing, fall within the mission and the values of the precinct at large? I mean, how does that fit into your bigger picture?
So there's a few of those, but those are probably two of the bigger events.
There's a number of them, yes.
Yeah, that's extremely important to us. If you don't mind, Scott, before I get to that, I think there was another change, which just so that we get the chronology correct. That chronology, so remember, if I go back to where we were, so it was like traditional IT, then we had this change into the digital era, and the next change that happened is that you know, with the need to create new enterprises in order to fix unemployment. Strange enough, the Europeans invested heavily on what in things like animation and gaming, so in the creative industries, because they believe we've got unique skills and content that differentiates us out from the rest of the world. But our showcase around all of this, so the thing in the creative industries, you know, you can't put, so there's two sides to that. You can't put a student in a room or someone who's just qualified from one art and put them in the room and expect that it's going to happen.
Yeah.
So we have to do a lot of enabling programs, of which the Fakugezi is almost the annual point at which it all culminates. So what we have to do is, first of all, we have to bring best of breed in animation, gaming, VR, because the reality, and I'm not, it's not a negative point, but the reality is the universities don't have through their degrees enough to make these guys even employable. Absolutely. Even employable. So they get their qualification, they get a degree, but then we have to do something above that. And that's what we do. So we've got the Molo Academy, we've got the Gaming Academy, in order to train these students so that they can either be employable or they can go
out
and
graduate. Give them actual work.
Yeah, and the experience. And you're right on, Scott, and the actual practical experience of working on projects. So you've covered one of the key building blocks. So what we put together is, first of all, we've got a great partner in a company called Goblin in Animation in France, and we send our very skilled people there for additional training. So it's called Train the Trainer program. Underneath that, we also have to ensure that you're able to train local people. So we're trying to get the collaboration with Goblin so that the trainers can then make it more available, as an example, to graduates in the art space. We have something called the Molo Academy, where we do the training, but we also have the Molo Studio. But the reality is, you know, we can probably accommodate 20 to 30. Sometimes we do double programs, but shorter things. But if we really want a meaningful impact, we've got to scale that. However, we also have to scale it so that from a production point of view, we can create work opportunity for it. But you know, there was a wonderful story that happened recently, because at Fakugezi, which is our digital arts festival, right, we bring in people from all over the world in showing the creativity and this intersect between creativity, digital, and technology.
Yeah.
But I spoke to three companies there who are SMEs who we had incubated, just to understand where they are. And they made an interesting observation, Stan, which you will enjoy. So they come out of, well, I think two of them, I don't think the third, but they both come out of having been students in the art science, the art faculty, and animation's their passion, or gaming's their passion. So we did the training while they got their degrees. We do the training in that space. But the reality, it's hard. And they wanted to be entrepreneurs. So their vision is to be enterprises that operates in that space. But the message that came back from them, so they said, you know, Mark, it's fantastic what you guys have done, but the reality, it's hard in this market to get commissioned work or work doing productions in animation or gaming. They says, but what happened to us, we created our companies, and then because of the fact we taught them a lot of the design work and creativity, this is, we up and running. He says, we're not here doing lots of animations or gaming, but I think it's used there. But the reality is, we're doing design work for companies. Yeah. He says, we're doing website development, we're doing content development, we're doing content marketing.
That sounds like me.
Exactly. So you have this, that the skills we gave them, and he says, but I still want to be an animator. But the reality is, you have to pay the bills at the end
Absolutely.
Of every month.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's now found other work. And so we're building that into our design now, that just says, yes, these guys have done animation degrees or gaming degrees, but let's give them the skills that if it's not that easy to land, you know, especially as a new company. That's why you don't have many large animation studios in South Africa. And the small ones hustle, right? I mean, right. They're normally dependent on the bigger studios, and the reality that we need to fix, because we're trying to fix unemployment. Mm. So we have to find a way, and I think we now understand that while they want to, like, they want to be animation, if we scale them in the creative areas, specifically in design and in website development and all that, they're going to be able to bootstrap themselves going forward. Because even when they've won money, it doesn't last very long. And South Africa, in reality, is not a great venture capital or investor market, right? It's just not. I think a lot of these guys struggle.
Are you seeing that potentially changing?
Look, everyone's got good intentions. I had a difficult discussion with someone over a few drinks on Saturday who comes out of the VC game.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, I think hopefully by the end of it, I persuaded him. That says, look, I'm actually tired of, you know, this. You see lots of articles in media and they list, but there is a private equity play, but it's not a VC play in the market. But the reality is you don't see the guys move from startup revenue generating to large organizations because of a lack of capital. So, you know, we get catalytic funding from various sponsors that we help these startups and SMMEs with. But I think for South Africa to get serious, we've got to get to stage one and stage two funding.
We
have to do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone claims to be doing it, but when you speak to the actual SMMEs themselves, they'll tell you that they get worn out, not down, they'll get worn out by even the fact that they have to pay back loans with interest rates that they can't afford. Because, you know, the reality is the VC game gives you more runway for you to establish and more risk capital, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of these guys, you know, the successful ones are still small, but they bootstrap themselves. They may have got an award or a grant somewhere. But the reality, you need to make capital available to small businesses. And I don't see that change happening, despite the fact there's lots of programs within government and private sector where they claim SMME support. But when I look at it from the SMME angle,
support is not there.
It's not there.
Right.
So, and related to that, I mean, I would love to see the first unicorn, South African unicorn, come out of the
good
precinct.
Luck. Oh, present.
Maybe,
oh,
you know, but
someone
is. Here's my question. What do you feel is different between South Africa and places like Nigeria that have seen more than one?
Yeah, Nigeria is sitting currently on four unicorns.
Like, what do you feel would be the difference that South Africa could maybe change its policy in some respect?
I think it's about capital and providing support. You know, so it's the other part of it, right? So, you know, you can give people money. And I think one of the big changes that we need to help is as a startup, they start off and then they're now a company and they're generating some revenue. They got some seed funding. And that's where South Africa is. In Nigeria, the guys have had access and they've been able to raise money.
Yeah.
They have been able to raise money within the Nigerian, but also from the British market. So the difference is that, you know, and I see South Africans like saying, oh, we've just raised £200 million, etc. And probably they wouldn't have made the cut through our processes, right?
Yeah.
So I think the difference is that available of capital and the willingness for people who have that capital to make those investments. But, you know, finding a unicorn it's a little bit like spraying, right?
Yeah.
You hope that you do a lot. And I think doing a lot's not bad, because even the guys who are not going to become unicorns, we see them being able to tackle the unemployment. I think there are unicorns that are probably one-third of the way there that will... And the other problem is when you don't have capital, it's difficult to scale. And I think a lot of our problems, we don't know how... We can't raise money here. Trust me, I've never known anyone who's really raised money here. I do get this research, which is around the investors, etc. And I can see that it's not just me who's thinking. So some of our sponsors are also saying, here's catalytic funding, but let's choose 2 out of 10. And let's go deep with them. We'll give you consistent investment over a longer period of time. So I think
that's
it's a
problem,
time.
Though, because I think if you look at Africa the Big Deal, Well, in one of their recent reports, they reported startup funding in South Africa at about 600 and something million US dollars. When you look at the startups listed there, you have TimeBank, you have Pineapple, and you have those. It's like they are startups, but really they're like...
They had access to capital anyway, trust me.
Right? So, you know what I mean? But that capital does not trickle down to like startups at Simulong.
That's
correct. And that cannot be a model to scale startups, because that definitely will not work. You can't wait for something like a TimeBank or Pineapple or a Naked Insurance for you to go, okay, startups, there they are, and you start pumping money into that.
Right.
That just wouldn't scale the sector. But here's my second question to this. You have traveled throughout the continent.
Yeah.
Through IBM, I think you were able to scale it through, I think, 13 countries?
Yeah, 24.
24 countries.
Mm-hmm.
Good Lord, that's a lot.
It's half the continent, yeah.
It's
most of the continent.
Yeah. That's a lot. That's almost half of it.
Yeah.
As the managing director, I think, at the point, the South African IBM managing director.
Yeah.
Now, what role is big tech playing in trying to capacitate startups in South Africa and throughout the continent? Because when you look at Simulong now, a lot of the support is not necessarily from big tech. It's from other organizations like the French Institute, Samsung here and there. But you don't see a lot of big tech work coming into the startups to try and scale them, which raises a lot of data extraction concerns to say, what are big techs doing in Africa? Are they just here to extract, or are they actually putting something in? You having scaled this big tech called IBM through 24 countries, have you seen them do work that's measurable with startups?
I think you have to start and see the bigger picture first, right? Mm. So the bigger picture looks like that, like this. You have these companies, with anyone, IBM, HP, Dell, etc., Amazon, Google. They look at Africa. And what do they see? Normally, they see three countries. They see Kenya, they see South Africa.
And maybe Nigeria.
No, they see Ghana.
Ghana.
Yeah, and the reason for this is all the negative hype that they read in the papers about issues. But Nigeria is the big market, actually. It's actually the big market. So then you say, okay, so I mean, I know, right? When I came over, that's where we had branch offices, was in there. But we were pushed over the edge that we had to go in every country because we signed the Bharti Airtel while I was in charge. So that's why I had to do the scaling. But the model for these big techs around new countries in Africa, where they go, where they create. So the obvious answer, and that's what you need to understand, is they look at building out a channel model and a reseller's model rather than establishing direct presence in those countries. Now, I can tell you that even those investments tend to go like this, right? Different countries, we in Africa have different problems. Foreign exchange is typically the big one, where they, you know, those companies like to deal in dollar-based deals, and suddenly they can't get their money out because Nigeria's foreign exchange control is no. You know, I don't know if you know, they do auctions for dollars, right? So a big bank there has to pay you money, but they can't find the dollars, so they have to, and they play around. So, but it's not just Nigeria; it happens all over the continent. And you know, every African country, you will find sometimes it's up, sometimes it's down. I mean, our local retailers will tell you the same thing, and you hear it all the time. You think we should disinvest from this country either for this reasons or corruption reason, or their harbors and ports are not working, or whatever it is. So it's a continuous strategic portfolio management about where they need to invest. Underneath that, you then say, and I think government is doing a lot to change this, because the reality is, so here's this, I'll explain to you what the real issue is. So here you are as the MD or CEO of a multinational in South Africa, and you've got what hanging over your head? what do you have hanging over your head as a local guy representing a multinational in South Africa?
I need to help him make money?
No.
Profits?
No. It's called broad-based black economic empowerment.
Okay.
So now you've got this regular condition that you have to bridge between the multinational.
Of course. Yeah.
Okay.
So
makes sense.
Yeah. So and it's a big challenge, right? So I remember I was the pioneer behind a lot of even the equity equivalent programs now called the EIP. I was the guy representing Americans in working with government to find an answer. So the reality of that is the companies, many of them, these big global tech companies, as the question was, will not give off ownership. It's not because they don't like PE or whatever. Their model just doesn't allow it because it breaks the entire transfer costs, management control. They don't want to have other boards having insights into their operations. Or sometimes they have to disinvest from you, and it's the way it is, right? They have to shut down, and then you got to go, and the board then says, no, but you're going to lose jobs. So they don't want to deal with that, and it's not their model all the world. So a lot of them are the big tech companies have the same model. Not just South Africa. Botswana's got something called Citizen Enabled Entity, the CEE, very similar to BE and other countries. So the BE is sort of coming through in various regulatory forms across the entire continent, right? So the easiest way, and then the second thing that has happened to those big multinationals is the governance, specifically because of SEC regulations. So, you know, it's hard. It's hard, right? Because things that you would think is pretty normal in South Africa will be a huge violation and potential risk, not just for the South African entity, but for the global entity. Okay? So you need to understand that model because it's very important, right?
Right.
So how do they invest in startups? And a lot of them are already burning, right? Or have burned because they've gone and they've said, we need to invest in startups because the government in South Africa is pushing us down. So you'll see what I like that government's done is that their equity equivalent programs, one government now understands, and is that you can't take your normal channel models and try and call this an equity investment program. So they're under pressure. And the government's used various directives about what they need these guys, because these guys are not giving off equity, but it means they have to invest. But some of them have already come foul of the controls required. So inside of these multinationals, it's hard for them even to make a selection. You know, you're going to get 10,000 people looking at how did you nominate this company for an investment. And there's this continuous, and it's ugly. It's not a nice thing, right? But we've got the BE, so which, you know, they have to conform to, and they have to invest in these equity equivalent. So I think the big investments are going to occur now.
Okay.
So we're running some programs already around what they call the EIP, the equity investment programs, into these startups. Some of the big tech companies will not give cash. So is it going to fit? So if your question is, are they suddenly going to make up for this gap in startup funding? The answer is no.
Okay.
In fact, I think they're going to be very selective. And governments, and the DTI has really tightened up on them about we've got to short true investments because one of the challenges.
They're not giving money, sorry. What are they giving?
So all of them do this. We're doing the same thing, and I don't think it's any more the case, right? They took their original channel program.
Okay.
Then they put on top of it, they would say, if you go, let's say it's a cloud provider, we will give you credits for the next 12 months and come and use our cloud. But so it's very much like their channel model, right?
Yeah. Right?
The other thing they're now doing is learning, right? Mm. Oh, we've got the best content available to teach you about AI or, you know, cloud or cybersecurity. It all looks like that, right?
Right.
And they're now saying, so then they put a financial value
It almost falls into their marketing budget almost.
It's the channel model, right? And that's what government's trying to stop. I don't know if they're going to be successful, right?
That model can work for incubation hubs. Give that package to an incubation hub so that as a value add to the incubation hub.
I want their money. Every single one will offer it to you. They'll give you cloud credits or this credits. We'll get you.
But it is effective.
I mean, the other one the other day was, we have experts in finance who can come in, and I'm like,
it's marketing,
it's marketing. You know, I have a saying, you know, CSI was like that, you know, you give so little but expect so much in return, right? And I think that change, the DTI is all over it, so I think we're in good hands.
Will they get it right?
Well, they're putting on, I can tell you, and I like what they're doing. There was one of them recently who we were about to get an investment from, and they came back and they said, no. It's okay for you to invest in Tsimulogong and Perth, but why can't you also do it in Limpopo or whatever? Right. So we've got really smart people now that are starting to make sure that we do things in order to drive the economy rather than being fooled just for the tick in the box.
Right. Yeah, that's a bit worrying, though, because I know the startup sector in South Africa is full of great products.
Yeah.
However, the problem is exactly that. They ended product.
Exactly.
You don't see a lot of output, like great innovations, but it was just end right there.
But it's capital. Yeah. And it's capital mentorship and coaching and post and post
regulation as well, right? Yeah. And frameworks as well. Yeah. Because one of the products that I worked with, I won't mention their name, they're still looking for 3 bar to try and build something. None of the government organizations, SPY, DTI, none of them could fund them. But the problem wasn't that this was an inferior product. The problem was none of those organizations were mandated to fund a project like that.
Mm-hmm.
If this guy had said, I want to produce this product and I need funding to go to China and have an assembly line in China to produce this product, one of those organizations would have given him the money.
Mm-hmm.
But when he said, I want to produce this locally, none of those organizations said, we have a mandate to help you with that. And we then have a lot of product that just ends there. Now, the entrepreneurs are frustrated going, argue that I have a bad product and I'll drop it hands down and I'll create something else. But when I'm stuck with a product that's great, but I can't seem to get funding from anyone.
That's the issue. You've got it.
I can't raise funding because the VC is going to go historic revenues.
Mm.
I can't go to any of the government funding arms because they are not mandated to fund something like this. Then where do I go?
But I'm starting to see that change happening. You know, like, so, I mean, some of the government departments, I mean, they've got great people are starting to make those changes. It's not yet here.
Okay.
But I've seen TIA, I've seen MICT, CETA, I've seen the DSI, I've seen Treasury start to try and earmark funding to get guys beyond from revenue generating. So, you know, they have this industrialist program. And it's sort of linked that how do we get money to really create those, I don't want to call it unicorns, but to create those entities we are going to scale because that's where job creation is going to come from.
And it's easier to create jobs through startups than through corporates.
Exactly.
You can get 1,000 startups to hire 50 people.
That's it. No corporate can do that. Corporates couldn't do that.
Couldn't do that, right? I mean, getting 1,000 startups
But I think there is alignment, right? Yeah. I can see government. I mean, you know, TIA has been great for us. I mean, they've come through and they said, we like your program. You know, why don't, instead of you only helping 5 startups to move to the next phase, we'd like you to do 8.
Mm.
So we're starting to see, but it's not necessarily pure funding. They do provide catalytic funding.
Okay.
But, you know, the longer term from moving from SMME to proper grown enterprises, that's going to be, so I'm worried we're going to end up with this new blockage. So, you know, the startups, I think, is there. I think there was a lot of money wasted on startups because most companies look for the PR moment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing companies tighten up that says, when if we're going to grant you funding, there's certain conditions you have to meet, which is good.
It should be,
yeah, because I've seen other guys, like the rich guys like Stan, who just go blow that money, right? R1 million and they blow the money, right? And I'm starting to see that there's more controls. around the regulation coming into play now that corporates are putting into their program.
It's just good business practice.
Yeah, exactly. I think it will be baked into everything. So, you know, I think that phase where startups just got awards and cash and disappeared and no one heard of them again, I think that's gone. We've seen more of the controls and governance coming. I think the next phase is post-incubation support.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah? And so we've got some great ideas about what we're going to do in post-incubation to make sure they really are successful.
Right.
But we also have to change our programs that we don't give them money and they disappear.
Yeah.
That the conditions is that we are able to support them, at least to guide them to the next phase of their development.
So that would be kind of a follow-up question from my side. I mean, your role as CEO at the precincts, at what point, I mean, what would be your measure of success? So say in a few years' time, you look back and you say, you know, you breathe a sigh of relief and you say, we did it, like we achieved what we wanted to do. What does that look like for you?
So there's three major objectives I've got, right? Mm-hmm. So the one is, as a precinct, we're quite small.
Mm-hmm.
I think we punch way above our weight with the amount of people that we've got. But in order to do that, we have some great sponsors. So historically, there was a high dependence on grants, and we're moving that away to running many more programs. But success looks as following, that I've scaled it outside even of the current precinct, that the amount of startups we've incubated and are successful is going to be the measuring point. So that's what success would look like. And that the third, which I think we're missing, there's the linkage to VITS and bringing in deep subject matter experts as part of the support we give startups is really important for me. And it takes up a lot of my time just to make sure that linkages exist. Mm-hmm. And then the third is that we need to create our own venture capital fund. I don't want to call it venture fund, call it an evergreen fund.
Yeah.
And we make enough profits from the scaling, etc., so that we can grow that fund, not for me or for anybody else, but for future generations. Because VITS has been wonderful as a shareholder, because they're really not expecting me to come back and give them money. Or they really want me to have impact. And so with that directive, I'll go back to the three things if you want. But it's really about scale, making sure they're really successful enterprises, and make sure we've got a fund in order to support them when we can't raise money for people who need the money.
Nice.
All right. You've had a lot of work in media, and The Angle, it's another media company startup, more of a publisher. I think you were with Kagiso Media at the time.
That's right.
And you helped them scale and transition into the digital age. I think at the point you were doing a lot of work with Jacaranda and East Coast Radio.
That's right.
In the wake of this anti-competitive campaign from Google, what does the future of media look like in South Africa?
Tough one.
But you know, I had an interesting experience recently talking to a very senior guy from Naspers, right? And I've watched their transition away from print, away from traditional media, into the digital space. And the reality is there's a convergence of, you know, e-commerce. You can't really separate from marketing, advertising, broadcasting, etc. So that marketing tech convergence is coming through all the time. And it's no longer the realm of a media company or a technology company. Some of them call themselves media companies, but they're technology companies. They're technology companies who are in media. So I think it's merely this transition, which is almost normal around this conversion and in the digital space. You know, I just presented at a function recently, and in my prep for the function, I think the thing that is sort of core to where I see this going to answer your question is there's this realism about the democratization of art, media, all of it, right? Because the youth have changed. So first of all, You know, just yesterday I spoke to someone. He says, you know, these two guys introduced you. They're both making money out of what you're doing. And I was like, how? Because, you know, and it's about the guys. It's democratized everything. Yeah. And digital has made the stuff in all these channels have made things available to them that they're not even depending on employment.
Right, right.
So two of these students were like, yay, we're already making money, my friend, just because they've been trained up on digital arts. So, you know, the opportunity, and it's no longer going to be the realm of individuals. I think even media will get, you know, I mean, let's face it. So the older guys still sit and watch news, journalism, things on television. He's young compared to me. But the youth don't, right?
Right.
They don't sit in front and watch you. They go onto YouTube and other TikTok channels.
And that's the thing. I mean, the generalist platforms, the media platforms, like, you know, your bigger News24s and so on. The model that supported those, that generalist approach to what you're doing is obviously, you know, disappearing. But it's actually quite an exciting time if you take a positive approach to it, to be in media in the sense that the rise of niche publications, the rise of niche outfits, and the ecosystem that can support them, they can run very cheap, number one.
Exactly.
But also their access to audience has never been the way it is now. Your opportunities for creating a very direct relationship with your audience, very direct relationship to your funders or partners, I don't think it's ever been better. So there's still some shifts happening. There's still some changes going on there. But yeah, the generalist platforms, everyone's scrambling. Everyone's trying to figure their ways out. Some saw it coming. So there's bigger publishers like the New York Times that pivoted and they understood the ecosystem. So now they're just rolling money. They can do what they want to do, like Financial Times as well. I think, how much did they make last year? 11 billion rand or something silly like that. You know, and their target's even higher next year. So there's some winners there. But yeah, some things like The Angle, there's opportunities still for space for these niche publications.
I also think, Scott, that the traditional media guys still want to retain the same brands and the same models, right? So publishing websites where they still do traditional journalism.
Will he survive?
I think there's too many people now. And you know, if guys like Scott actually starts using something like this to get the journalistic integrity into freelancers on the youth and teach them how to make channels available and how to commercialize.
Right, right. That's so very important. Sustainability.
Exactly. And I'm telling you, all of a sudden, I think we're going to get journalism at a different level. Not traditional journalism, but we're going to get, you know.
There's a hybrid that's brewing.
I remember.
We can't just rely on traditional methods. We have to build in technologies for sustainability.
And not just from a corporate or traditional publisher.
Yeah.
I think news should be coming from everywhere. You know, I remember my son, who's now a lecturer at UJ, used to get so irritated around what he saw on television and the news. And he showed me one day. He said, Dad, let me just show you what I do. And he went onto his laptop, and he had these feeder systems. But it wasn't from media companies. It's from people who were freelance reporting. And with a twist, right? Mm. It was a total twist for him. And I said, Chadwin, you know, like, you're weird enough. Why are you still doing this? You should get this balance.
Mm.
Because really, let's face it, some of the journalists, their opinions and their interpretation is very valuable. We can never do without it, right?
Right.
Whereas just getting raw inputs of things is, you're going to lose that value. So we've got to get that balance. Balance.
We're seeing what we call a rise of the influencer journalist.
Exactly. Yes.
And the trick there is obviously that particular individual needs to have some sort of credibility to them. And but the ethics of journalism needs to sit with the individual rather than the organization.
That's the point.
So we're starting to see a fair amount of that.
And I think it's the role of the traditional media companies and the journalists to start to get that stuff implemented. Because the reality is, you can sit on social media and you can see so much fake news. I mean, that's just out there.
Yeah, and I think, you know,
the tech will fix it.
Yeah.
I mean, you get AI detecting fake news even before the person tries to publish it.
Yeah.
So it'll get better and better. I see some countries are even stopping social media now. I'm like, I see in Malaysia something is stopping Temu, right? And so we'll get that. Yeah. But the reality is you can't stop progress. Admit it. This is progress, right? But what I don't see, Scott, I'd like to get your view, is that there's some youth, maybe trained or not trained in journalism, who is an independent, who gives you insights that you can't get. I've not seen that. I don't know if you know. You know, some of it's very informative. So I'm not saying they're not informative. Yeah. But I'm really not seeing that influencers having the type of impact that journalism
I would like to see, you know, the needle between influencer and journalist, leaning a little more towards journalists. Using the tools of the influencer, but being a little more of a journalist.
I agree.
And that's the space. You got to find those individuals and train them up a little bit. And,
yeah.
Because a lot of them just want to be stars before they're, you know, they're interested in the space of news, quote unquote, but they're more still at this stage. They're more interested in being, you know, having that star aspect to what they're doing.
But you mustn't let them lose that.
But you want that, but you also want them to understand that the ecosystem that they want to display themselves as has ethics, has credibility to it.
Yeah.
But I think you had this experiment at the Mail and Guardian with Susan Boff Walsh.
Yeah, we tried that.
Yeah. Was that a success? I mean, he's got some good news.
For the most part, yeah. Yeah.
So it works.
Yeah.
It works.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it works.
Yeah.
I'll tell you why.
Yeah?
Because let's look at some of the big changes in the world, right? Rather than you having some of the big social media channels or even the Googles dominate the control of content, if I was the CEO of a big media company, I would almost create a gig environment which individuals can commercialize and then put that journalistic integrity on 100%. Top of it.
Mm.
And then instead of publishing it as your own, you publish that stuff out but with a stamp.
Mm. Absolutely.
That says our researchers have verified authenticity and the payment goes back to the person rather than people trying to grab this. The problem is everyone's trying to grab this and owning the content.
I mean, that idea, it's not so dissimilar to the way things have operated in the sense that you do have your star journalists. You've got these journalists bring your credibility to your organization, not always just the other way.
Exactly.
And you want to find that two-way road. And that's exactly to the point. You want these individuals to be doing the work, doing what they do. But you want to be in a space where they have that credibility. Where do they get that from?
Exactly.
There has to be an organization.
That's a great business model for you to go and get this guy to build you a gig thing, but you get the you make sure it's got the quality and standards.
Yeah.
Mm. Don't interfere with the creativity.
Mm-mm.
But I think if someone gets that right to put the stamp onto the stuff that says we vetted the article, this is, you know, I think, you know, going back to my son's view about what he wanted to see is where the youth is today. And I think whoever does that will probably be the winner. Yeah.
Interesting.
I think we're out of time, so
our producer is
maybe wrap it up.
Right on time.
Does he charge you more? If you want to go?
I think he'll charge us. So we need to wrap it up.
We done? Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Harris, thank you so much for joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been the Angle Podcast. Please like, subscribe, follow us. All the links will be in the description below. Until next time, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. Cheers, Scott.